what is going on here, and you look at the situation. I mean, here's King David, the king, the man after God's own heart, one that God has greatly blessed, one who took the place of Mephibosheth's grandfather, as king. And you look at Mephibosheth, and just who is he? Well, obviously he's a son of Jonathan. We know that, the grandson of Saul. That's easy. But he's a man that's also in 1 Chronicles, and we'll just notice this very quickly. In 1 Chronicles chapter 8, and Chronicles is just that, the first 10 or so chapters are basically the chronicles of who's the genealogies, if you will. In chapter 8, verse 33, this is beginning. It says, Ner begot Kish, Kish begot Saul, Saul begot Jonathan, Malchishua, Abinadab, and Eshbaal. The son of Jonathan was Merabel, and Merabel begot Micah. Little different names, spellings and so on, are different names in chapter 9, verses 39. Same thing repeated. Ner begot Kish, Kish begot Saul, Saul begot Jonathan, Malchishua, Abinadab, and Eshbaal. The son of Jonathan was Merabel, and Merabel begot Micah. So sometimes people want to make a big difference between why are there two different names. I don't know. We don't know. And there are the scholars that profess to know, but obviously that's something that does not change the facts. And so this Mephibosheth had been lame from the time he was 5 years old. And going back to 2 Samuel chapter 4, and we're going to be spending most of our time in 1 and 2 Samuel. In chapter 4, verse 4, this is the day that the news came to the palace that Saul and all of his four sons had all been killed in battle. And the nurse, verse 4, it says, Jonathan, Saul's son, had a son who was lame in his feet. He was 5 years old when the news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel, and his nurse took him up and fled. She was fleeing with him to protect him. And it happened as she made haste to flee that he fell and became lame. And his name was Mephibosheth. So you can imagine. Now he's old enough to have his own son, Micah. He's a descendant of Saul. He's one of the few left. He's lame. What does he have on his side? And it's not good, because very commonly in those times, and not just in Israel, but in the countries around them, when a new king came in, what did they want to do? They wanted to establish their throne. And in 1 Kings chapter 15, 1 Kings chapter 15, there, verse 29, and we're not going to read all of them. There's a number of them that is stated very much the same way. But we do want to just notice a couple of them here that are kind of close together. Chapter 15, and I'm working my way through there, but I'll get there in a moment. Baasha is now, has killed Nadab, Jeroboam's son, and it says, and verse 29, and it was so when he became king that he killed all the house of Jeroboam. He did not leave to Jeroboam anyone that breathed until he had destroyed him according to the word of the Lord, which he had spoken by his servant Ahijah, the Shilonite. Now this was the will of God, but this is something that he probably would have done even if it wasn't, because he's a usurper. He's not of the family. In order to establish his kingdom, to make it firm, I'm going to kill all of them. I'm going to be done with them. There's nobody that can can claim to be the rightful heir. Chapter 16, verse 2. Inasmuch as God says, as I lifted you up out of the dust and made you ruler over my people Israel, and you have walked in the way of Jeroboam and have made my people Israel to sin, to provoke me to anger with their sin. Surely I will take away the posterity of Baasha and the posterity of his house, and I will make your house like the house of Jeroboam the son of Nebat. The dog shall eat whoever belongs to Baasha and dies in the city, and the birds of the air shall eat whoever dies in the field. Not only are they all going to be killed, but they're not even going to be buried. They're going to be eaten by the animals. And go with me, if you will, now to 2 Kings. And we're going to be looking at here Jehu. There was a Jehu, a prophet. This is Jehu the king. And verse 1. After Jehu has taken over, has killed one of Ahab's sons, here in verse 1 of chapter 10 it says, now Ahab had 70 sons in Samaria. And Jehu wrote and sent letters to Samaria, to the rulers of Jezreel, to the elders, and to those who reared Ahab's sons. Okay, so who is this? This is where these people are. Now as soon as this letter comes to you, since your master's sons are with you, and you have chariots and horses, a fortified city also and weapons, choose the best qualified of your master's sons, set him on his father's throne, and fight for your master's house. But they said, no, you've already killed not one king, but two kings. Who are we to stand up before you? And so skip down, if you will, to verse 6. Then he wrote a second letter to them, saying, if you are for me and will obey my voice, take the heads of the men, your master's sons, and come to me at Jezreel by this time tomorrow. Now the king's sons, 70 persons, were with the great men of the city who were rearing them. So it was when the letter came to them that they took the king's sons and slaughtered 70 persons, put their heads in the basket, and sent them to him at Jezreel. Now we're going to skip over the next part of it, because it gets even a little grosser. But now let's get down to verse 12. The sons of Ahab in Israel are dealt with, but they're the descendants of Ahab in Israel. In Judah. And it says in verse 12, and he arose and departed and went to Samaria. And on the way at Beth Eked of the shepherds, Jehu met with the brothers of Ahaziah, one of the sons of Ahab, king of Judah, and said, who are you? So they said, we are the brothers of Ahaziah, the one you just killed. By the way, we have come down to greet the sons of the king and the sons of the queen mother. And he said, take them alive. So they took them alive and killed them at the well of Beth Eked, 42 men, and he left none of them. And finally in verse 17, and when he came to Samaria, he killed all who remained to Ahab in Samaria, till he had destroyed them according to the word of the Lord which he spoke to Elijah. So this was the common thing. This was what was normally done, and you understand it. It's perfectly logical. This not just in this time period. It happened throughout the ages. And so when Mephibosheth is brought to King David's palace, and I mean, somebody had to go get him in a chariot to bring him back. And what do you think he's thinking as he's coming to David's palace? David has called for you. Well, at least he didn't just have him killed. But you can imagine that he doesn't know what's coming. He's probably like most of us. Yes, there may be good, but it's probably not going to be good. It's going to be bad. He's going to kill me. And Mephibosheth was dependent on others. He didn't have his own house. He had a family, but he didn't have a place to live. In 1 Samuel, going back again to 1 Samuel chapter 9, there at verse 4, David asked, where is he? And Ziba said to the king, indeed, he is in the house of Maker, the son of Amiel in Lodibar. So that's where he is. He's living as a guest, if you will, in the family of, but he has little relationship, if any, to them. although this Machir does seem to be a brother-in-law to David, because he is the sister of Bathsheba. And so, what can we learn from this? And you think, well, from Mephibosheth, this man that has nothing, this man that's lame, this man that can't even depend, work for himself, what can he do? What can we learn from such a person? And I think we're going to notice there's one particular characteristic that is very evident in Mephibosheth. But I also want us to notice what we can learn from David. Because David is called a man after God's own heart. And I think this is one of the places that we see this. So here in 2 Samuel, and most of our time will be here from now on, in verse 1, "Now David said, is there still anyone who is left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" Now it's interesting that a number of the commentators put all the emphasis on this covenant with Jonathan. And in 1 Samuel, if you may remember there, that as David and Jonathan are parting, they know probably for the last time, Jonathan, speaking here, says, "And you shall not only so show me the kindness of the Lord while I still live, that I may not die." And he's already said, "I know, you'll be king and I'll be your right-hand man, but promise me, you won't kill me." But he goes on to say, "But you shall not cut off your kindness from my house forever. No, not when the Lord has cut off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth." So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "Let the Lord require it at the hand of David's enemy." Now Jonathan again caused David to vow, because he loved him. For he loved him as he loved his own soul. So there is this covenant. Jonathan and David vowed to each other. When I'm killed, you and your house have kindness to me and to my house. Don't kill my descendants. And I will not minimize the covenant, the vow. That was something that certainly to David was very strong because of their relationship together. But I tend to think that it wasn't motivated as much by the covenant as it was that he really, out of love for Jonathan, wanted to know, is there someone that I can help? And so David, because of this faithfulness, wanted to show compassion. And he did it in a big way, didn't he? Verse 1, "I will show him compassion." Skipping down to verse 7. And you may remember, and we read there in verse 6, David said, "Mephibosheth, if that's you, Mephibosheth." And he answered, "Here is your servant." And notice that it says he fell on his face. He prostrated himself. I mean, how much lower can he get? And I think we understand. He knew what the situation could be. But what does David immediately say? "So how are things going?" No. He says, "Do not be afraid. I know there's fear in you. If you're not totally petrified, you're afraid to some extent. Do not be afraid." And let's just read here. He says, "For I will surely show you kindness for Jonathan your father's sake." What is that kindness? "I will restore to you all the land of Saul, your grandfather." Now, Saul, as king, in the 40 years that he was king, amassed a great deal of land. It was so big that Ziba, his 15 sons, and his 20 servants were required to take care of it. to plant it, and etc. And it seems that probably Ziba was the owner, if you will, of this land. He was the servant of Saul, and when Saul died, it seems to have gone to him. But David says, now I'm giving that to you. And I'm commanding Ziba and his sons and his servants to till the land so that you will have money, so that you will have what you need. And then perhaps the greatest of all there, he says, and you shall eat bread at my table continually. You won't be a guest from time to time. You will be part of my family. And it says there a little bit later on, verse 11, as for Mephibosheth, said the king, he shall eat at my table like one of the king's sons. You'll just be another one of my sons. Now, did David have to do that? No. David could have said, I'm so glad you're here. Why don't you stay a month? Why don't you stay? And I'll give you some money. No, David made him to feel like you are part of my family. I love Jonathan. I don't know you. I've not met you. But you are part of my family. I want you to be as Jonathan would be if he was here. So from David, certainly we can learn faithfulness, faithful love, and compassion. But what about Mephibosheth? And here's a man that for all of his life has been inferior. A man who has depended with others, on others, for all of his, not even adult life, since the time he was 5 or 6 years old. And I think one of the things surely that we see clearly is his humility. When he comes in verse 6, he says, here is your servant. And as I've already we've already noticed, he fell down on his face. I mean, he couldn't go any lower. If he opened his mouth and stuck his tongue out, he would be licking the ground. And you talk about humbling yourself. That's what he did. And I think basically, and I've put it into our words, it says, who am I that you should favor me? Why would you do this? And it's interesting that this is not only on this occasion. Because, you know, sometimes as people, particularly men perhaps, when they're raised to some position of something, I mean, he's never been anything, and now he's one of the king's sons. Does that go to his head? No. Is this all just because he's got to get in good with David? No. Let's go on to chapter 19. And notice that this continues throughout all the time that he's there with David. You remember that Absalom, David's son, rebelled against him. You know that that didn't work. That Absalom was killed. Those who were with him were punished, including Ziba. But here in chapter 19, at verse 24, now Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king. David is coming back from the other side of the Jordan. And he had not cared for his feet, nor trimmed his mustache, nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he returned in peace. All of this were signs of mourning, of this is not right, I am mourning, I am fasting, I am praying to God for the safe return of the king. So it was when he had come to Jerusalem to meet the king, that the king said to him, why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth? I think that's a valid question. And he answered, my lord, O king, my servant deceived me. For your servant said, I will saddle a donkey for myself, that I may ride on it and go to the king, because your servant is lame. And he has slandered your servant to my Lord the King. But my Lord the King is like the angel of God. Therefore do what is good in your eyes. Now David had asked Ziba, who had come out to help him, where's Mephibosheth? And he says, oh, Mephibosheth stayed there because he said, surely they'll restore the kingdom to me now. Now, I mean, just think about that. Absalom's trying to be king. And Mephibosheth, who's nothing, is going to say, okay, this is my day. They're going to put me in as king. Really? That doesn't even make sense. But notice, Mephibosheth said, that was what I was going to do, but I couldn't. And he says, and he has slandered me to you. But he says, but you're like the angel of God, you know. And he says, therefore do what is good in your eyes. He doesn't say, now David, don't listen to him. David, he's a liar. David, you've got to believe me. He says, you do what you think is right. And he goes on to say, for all my father's house were but dead men before my Lord the King. Yet you set your servant among those who eat at your own table. Therefore, what right have I still to cry out any more to the King? I am grateful. I am thankful for what you've done, because I'm just like a dead dog. And that's, you know, that's kind of a strange phrase to us, because what's he saying? Well, he's like Sadie, who got killed, got run over in the middle of the road? No. Because dogs were not pets. Dogs were scavengers. Dogs and pigs were on the same level. They were, if you touched them, you were unclean. And if you touched the body of a dead animal like that, you were unclean. And so when he said, why have you had compassion on me, on such a dead dog as I? He was saying, I'm the lowest of the low, and I recognize this. And he wasn't the only one to say this. In 1 Samuel chapter 24, David himself says the same thing to Saul. When Saul is pursuing him, is trying to kill him, David reminds him, or just says, and after whom has the king of Israel, you're the king of Israel, come out? Whom do you pursue? A dead dog? A flea? You're the king, you're the all-powerful, and you're worrying about this dead dog, this flea. And how big's the flea? You can almost see them. A little bit later, on another occasion, again, the same thing, verse 20 of chapter 26. So now do not let my blood fall to the earth before the face of the Lord. For the king of Israel has come out to seek a flea, as when one hunts a partridge in the mountains. This is how Mephibosheth felt about himself before David. And I think in the beginning we could say, well, you know, he better. Because if he comes in there strutting around, David's going to say, forget it, buddy. I don't think David would have, but, you know, there's certainly that danger. But he realizes, who am I? What am I? And yet, you have had pity on me. And it's interesting, and someone pointed out, and I think I would hate to say that David is a type of God in this situation, but I think that there is a very strong resemblance there. Because when we think about, what did David do? David showed kindness to the undeserving. Did Mephibosheth in himself, who he was, deserve this? No, he didn't. He showed kindness to the powerless. what has God done for us? He has showed kindness to the undeserving. He has showed kindness to the powerless. God has showed kindness to men who are all crippled by sin. Are, if we're living in sin, are we fulfilling our best life, our greatest destiny? No. Sin cripples us. And God shows kind to the powerless. Because when we sin, when we have sinned, we stand before God. What power do we have? What bargaining tools do we have with God? We have none. And just as David showed kindness to Mephibosheth, who had nothing, God shows kindness to us who have nothing. And David offered fellowship to the weak, to Mephibosheth. And I don't think it's hard for us to see the parallel here. God offers restoration to us, to sinners. God offers fellowship to sinners, to those who have been separated from Him. God sent His only begotten Son to die in our place. What can we learn from David and his interaction with Mephibosheth? Quite a bit. Because indeed, David was a man after God's own heart. And that forgiveness that David offered to Mephibosheth.